From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. History lessons can be fun and sometimes frightening. Today we'll talk about a worldwide social event that celebrates a giant of Scottish literature, and we'll remember the victims of the Atlanta race riot 110 years on. That's all coming up this hour. First, though...
Why don't you take a picture? It'll last longer!
We talked about a new online archive of rare old photos yesterday. They're available to everyone for free now, courtesy of the New York Public Library. And many of the images give us a glimpse into life in Georgia in the early 20th century. Historian Stan Deaton scrolled through the archive with us.
Well, it's really a treasure trove, isn't it? I mean, it's like pulling a box out from under your grandmother's bed and seeing things that you've never seen. As a historian, for instance, I've been reading about the election of 1868 for most of my professional life. It was the first presidential election post-Civil War, the first one in which recently freed slaves were now voting. I mean, what a historic day that was. And there in that collection was a photograph from Presidential Election Day 1868 in Savannah.
We wondered what you think, as we always do, and we asked about tangible photographs in a digital world. Are they still valuable to you? Here are your first thoughts.
My name is Carmen Crawford. I believe that today people use their phones in such a constant manner that there's so much information, but at the same time, so much information is being lost, whereas in the past, photographs were held on to for dear life.
We also asked you to share the stories behind the photo treasures in your personal collections, and we got some great ones, like this.
This is Caitlin White, calling from Athens, Georgia, and my great-grandfather, Fred Brunson, was stationed on the USS Missouri throughout World War II, and he happened to be there on the day that the Japanese surrendered, and he had a small Polaroid camera with him and was able to capture all these great images from the surrender ceremony. And we've kept them in the family and passed them down and recently donated them to a museum for military history.
We love getting your thoughts. Call us like Carmen and Ed did. It's 404-500-9457. You can leave us a message. We're also on Twitter at OSD Talk or post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. And we might feature your comments on the show. You know, it's probably not surprising that there are birthday celebrations for the Scottish poet Robert Burns in Scotland every year. But every year around his birthday, the writer's also remembered in places like Athens, Georgia. The gatherings are called Burns Suppers, and they're held all over the world. GPB's Sam Whitehead attended a Burns Supper this year in Athens and brings us this story.
Tartan plaid covers the Athens Cotton Press, an old industrial building converted into a banquet hall. It's on the tablecloths, the flags that line the room, and the guests. Men in kilts and women in scarves enter to jaunty Celtic music. Some head to the cash bar for glasses of whiskey. Others check out the slideshow, projecting lines of verse on the wall. And then come the bagpipes. They signal the start of this evening's celebration of the life and work of Robert Burns. The first Burns Supper was held in 1801, 5 years after Burns died, and they've been happening ever since. While the dinners take a standard form, there's no central body organizing them. The events are grassroots, put together by people all over the world with a love for Scotland's bard.
I grew up with Robert Burns because my mother was Scottish, and he embodies the soul of Scotland. I think that's the way to put it.
Ian Harden says the suppers help him celebrate his Scottish heritage. He's a retired chemist and the man behind tonight's 140-seat dinner. He's also the MC and has the honor of reading Burns's ode to perhaps the dinner's most honored guest, the haggis.
But if you wish her grateful prayer, give her a haggis.
Haggis, in case you don't know, is a mixture of sheep's organs, oatmeal, and spices boiled in a sheep's stomach. It's not fine dining, but Burns' poem does what many of his works do, elevate the everyday. Tonight, the haggis sits at the end of the buffet line, where it's served with a southern twist, on buttered saltine crackers. There's also mock haggis wrapped in phyllo dough, and other takes on traditional Scottish fare.
We have kakiliki soup, neeps, and potatoes with turnips and rutabagas. Oh, the mushy peas, and that's just what it says, mushed up peas. We put a little cream in them, it makes them a little better.
Lee Epting is the man behind tonight's food. The mock haggis was his idea.
I'm sorry for all you Scots out there, but far better than the real thing.
Epting says he's not much of a Burns aficionado, though he's hoping to learn more. For him, the suppers are a great excuse to throw a party. After dinner, more entertainment. There's bagpiping and Highland dancing, toasts among the sexes, and more of Burns' poetry.
The best laid schemes, O mice and men, gang after glay, and Lias, nought but grief and pain for promised joy.
There's also a short lecture on Burns' life and work. This year's comes from Elizabeth Kraft, who teaches English at the nearby University of Georgia.
People are just moved and they recognize themselves, I think, in the poetry.
Kraft says that feeling's not exclusive to people with Scottish heritage, but open to anyone who connects with Burns' work. Burns was also just a regular guy with regular faults, and Kraft says that's another part of his appeal.
There's just something about the way he's so honest about his limitations, his failings, that kind of connects us. It's very, very human. And I think that that's the thing that will always touch people.
Like all Burns suppers, this one ends in song. With some gentle goading, guests stand, join hands, and start singing Burns' familiar tune, Auld Lang Syne. The song asks whether it's worthwhile to celebrate the past. The answer, at least for these Burns supper attendees, sounds like a resounding yes. For GPB News, I'm Sam Whitehead in Athens.
Auld Lang Syne is probably the most famous of Robert Burns' works, and you just heard a bit of it in Sam's piece. Here's a more recent version performed by Scottish singer Susan Boyle.
For
Auld Lang Syne is also an example of a popular holiday song that has nothing to do with the holiday on which it's sung. So what does Auld Lang Syne mean, and why is it connected to New Year's? If it's something we all say but don't really understand, it's a good time to break it down.
Break it down, break it down, baby, because I want y'all all to know. Let me break it down for you again.
Break it down now.
Break it down.
Let's start with the meaning of the words, Auld Lang Syne. We're talking about Old Scottish here, and it's really hard to find a real equivalent in English. Auld Lang Syne roughly translates to old long since, or times gone by.
Play it once, Sam. For old time's sake, play as time goes by.
Oh, I can't remember it myself. I'm a little rusty on it.
Right sentiment, wrong song. When you sing For Auld Lang Syne, you're saying for the sake of old times. That's why you should never sing For the Sake of Auld Lang Syne, because that's like saying for the sake of old times. Get it?
I don't understand. Isn't that just the saddest thing you ever heard?
The first known use of the phrase dates back to the 1500s. But that's not the version we know. Our version comes from Robert Burns, the national poet of Scotland. Toward the end of his life, Burns became really interested in folk music and traditional songs. He found the lyrics to Auld Lang Syne and sent them to someone at the Scottish Musical Museum. He included a note that said,
"The following song, an old song of the olden times, and which has never been in print, nor even in manuscript until I took it down from an old man."
The tune we all sing isn't the one Robert Burns used either. The original tune, so we're told, sounded like this. Here's Scottish singer and musician Davy Lees performing it for us.
Should all the acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should all the acquaintance be forgot and Auld Lang Syne?
It's a beautiful melody, but it's not the one most of us sing at 12:01 on January 1st. Why did the tunes get changed and when? No idea. But I can answer that question about what the song means. The fact is, Auld Lang Syne was never intended to be a New Year's song or even a holiday song. It really just says, we should remember old friends and the good things they've done. And it calls for a toast, that cup of kindness. In fact, in true Scottish tradition, it mentions having a drink no less than 8 times.
It is time for some more drinking games. These are some games we play near some drinking.
Now, before we leave the history behind, here's a fun fact about Robert Burns. He's so beloved in Scotland that in 2009 he won a vote for the greatest Scot of all time, narrowly beating William Wallace.
Tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
And David Tennant of Doctor Who fame.
I'm sitting in the TARDIS now, and I'm going to wind up soon, but not before I make a few strange noises with my mouth that will go somewhere along the lines of bingle bongle, dingle dangle, yickety doo, yickety da, ping pong, lippy tappy too ta.
Sean Connery didn't even make the top 10.
Do you expect me to talk? No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Anyway, back to Auld Lang Syne. The final question we need to answer is this. Why do we sing it on New Year's?
What does this song mean? My whole life, I don't know what this song means. I mean, should old acquaintance be forgot? Does that mean that we should forget old acquaintances? It doesn't mean that if we happen to forget them, we should remember them, which is not possible because we've already forgot them.
Well, maybe it just means that we should remember that we forgot them or something. Anyway, it's about old friends.
In Scotland, New Year's Eve is a friendly event called Hogmanay. That's the day when some Scots swing balls of fire around, sprinkle water all over their houses, and give gifts to tall, dark men who enter their houses soon after midnight. They also cross their arms across their chests, link hands, and sing Auld Lang Syne. The tradition of singing that song spread fairly quickly all over the British Isles, and if some experts are to be believed, it was bandleader Guy Lombardo that made it popular in the U.S.
Happy New Year!
Yes, sir, Happy New Year, gang. This is Guy Lombardo adding the musical postscript to your Swing Around the Clock.
Guy Lombardo was the Dick Clark of his time. He and his band rang in the New Year for millions of Americans for almost 50 years. Back in 1929, he used Auld Lang Syne as filler music during a New Year's radio broadcast at the Roosevelt Hotel in New York, and the tradition caught on. It is now a worldwide phenomenon. In Japan, stores play it to let customers know that it's closing time. And in China, it's so widely played that many people think it's an old Chinese folk tune. It is not. It's even made its way onto the pop charts in some places. This song, Poor Jim, was a hit for the Danish band Gasolin. In 1997, as Hong Kong prepared to move from English rule to Chinese, the pipers of the Royal Hong Kong Police Force played Auld Lang Syne as the last British governor left his official residence.
The tune of Auld Lang Syne being played now by the police band. It's another traditional Scottish tune to say farewell.
So the song has come a long way from that old man who once sang it for Robert Burns back in the 1700s, but most people still don't know the words. So we're going to help you out with that. We've posted the lyrics at our Facebook page. This is On Second Thought. Race, religion, and politics don't really make for polite conversation among friends, but they make for great drama. The play Disgraced tackles issues like Islamophobia and Muslim-American identity head-on through its character, Amir Kapoor. Amir is a very successful Pakistani-American lawyer, but he tries to distance himself from his Muslim roots.
I'm not going to be on a legal team because your imam is a bigot.
He's not a bigot. He'd just be more comfortable if there was a Muslim on the case, too.
More comfortable if he wasn't represented by a couple of Jews.
No, he liked you. He said you were a good man.
Maybe he will feel differently if he knew how I really felt about his religion.
Disgraced won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama back in 2013. It makes its Atlanta debut tonight at the Alliance Theater, and here with me now is the playwright, Eyad Akhtar. Welcome to On Second Thought.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, I think a lot of people have in their minds the relationship between a director of a film and a screenwriter, right? You imagine Martin Scorsese sitting there with the other screenwriters and constantly revising the scripts and blah, 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 blah. That's not exactly what happens in theater. I mean, once something wins the Pulitzer, isn't that script set in stone?
Usually. the show was up in 2012 in New York at Lincoln Center, and it won the Pulitzer subsequent to that. But I was already in rehearsals for a production in London at that point, and I was changing the script. So when the script went up in London, it was different than it had been in New York. And, of course, it was reported in the papers that I was changing my script and that this is something that is not usually done post-Pulitzer.
Yeah, you can imagine them looking down their noses. Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, while I'm very deeply, deeply honored and deeply grateful for winning a prize like that, I didn't give it the prize. So that, you know, it doesn't, the process can't be completed just because somebody else says something. It can only be completed when the work is completed. So there was a little bit more work that we did on the show between London and Broadway. It opened on Broadway in the fall of 2014. And I think at this point, for the most part, the script is finished.
So you're not here in Atlanta tinkering?
No, not anymore.
So what is your relationship when you come to, when a new production is being opened? What is your relationship with production?
It's really support. I mean, I think that it's support on an artistic level to be able to talk to the staff of the theater or to get people excited about the show, you know, doing some kind of a public events or an interview
or
like
doing
this. Right, an interview right. like this, which helps get the word out in the community. You know, I think that when you put a play up, it's not, I wrote a play, now you're doing my play. It's, we're all in this together. And so as much as possible, I feel like every theater that undertakes the work of a playwright is a group endeavor, and I think that a writer, if a writer has the time and the energy, playing a role can be really helpful to a theater.
You know, it's been quite a number of years since you actually began writing this. You started the writing on it when?
I had a first draft done in 2009, and I think I think a real draft that resembles something like what is now showing up on stages was the first time was 2010.
So I wonder, especially with all of the discussion of refugees going on, with all of the very heated rhetoric that we're hearing, especially from GOP presidential candidates like Donald Trump, I wonder if watching at this point rehearsals of this production here in Atlanta, you have it rings differently than when you wrote it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that's really surprised me about this play, and I was just talking about this with Susan Booth, was that I think when I wrote the play 5 years ago, you could never have imagined, you know, there's a point in the play at which language between people seems to have become so devolved and degraded that you just don't understand.
Yeah, they don't even speak to each other anymore.
Yeah,
like they're not understanding each other at all.
No, and there's really nasty, vitriolic sort of rhetoric that begins to emerge between these people. And, you know, 5 years ago, I think you could have said, you could never have imagined that language would have degraded so much in the public space as it has now. And so in an odd way, I think the play was prescient about the way we would be speaking to each other because of identity and race issues at a time where now the theater is happening in a public space and it doesn't feel all that different than what people are going to go home and watch on television when they hear the latest rally, Trump rally or whatnot, or the aftermath of the latest Trump rally, or pull up their Facebook feed and see what people are writing. It just seems like language has taken on a different valence and a different grit at this point.
And I wonder what that means for you as you write further plays. I mean, what you're talking about is the experience I had. I spoke to you shortly after you won the Pulitzer Prize for the show Tell Me More at NPR. And when I went back and reread the play, you know, when I first read it, those scenes that you're talking about seemed very much drama, right? This is what you do when you're trying to make a point. You have an extreme conversation where things really, really break down. Now, it doesn't even seem, it seems more like a reality show. Like, that's...
I don't even know about a reality show. Reality.
Yeah,
this is how people are talking. This is how people are talking to each other in the street.
And what does that mean for you as a writer, as you move forward, actually writing new scenes like that?
Well, I'm not writing new scenes like that. I mean, I think that I've moved on to. You know, I think the audience is always 3 years, you know, behind where a writer is. You know, so I'm on to other stuff, but. I think it's interesting to notice that what may have seemed dramatic or theatrical at one point has actually just is actually just keeping pace with reality right now. So,
yeah.
But I think it's why the play has the resonance it does.
So let me ask you about the resonance, because obviously this play focuses on a Muslim American, a Pakistani American main character. But to a certain extent, you're not really talking just about religious identity. You seem to really be just talking about identity, period. What we choose, what the identity our family gives us versus the identity we choose versus the way people see us. Mm-hmm. Is that fairly accurate?
I think so. I mean, I certainly know that the fundamental dilemma for the lead character is that he wants to be seen how he wants to be seen. And he wants to be seen not as somebody who is Muslim. And he doesn't want to be seen as somebody who people say is Pakistani. He doesn't want any of those signifiers. And as an American, he has the false belief that he can make himself into whatever he wants to be. That's the great American myth. And so in a post-9/11 world, the play stages the impasse of a man who would define himself by his own lights and by his own language and pits him against an environment where he is going to be constantly reminded that he is a Muslim, even though he doesn't believe he's a Muslim. And I think that's an interesting and rich dramatic circumstance, and it's riven by a kind of failure on the part of this protagonist fundamentally to understand who he really is. That you can't necessarily just decide you want to be somebody, and you do have to account on some fundamental level for who you are and where you come from, that's part of who you are.
It reminds me of a conversation that we've had, especially increasingly of late, with there's a certain group of people who will say they're colorblind, right? Like, oh, I don't see color. And then there's the reality of the fact that, well, it exists, and it actually makes a difference in our lives, the way you're treated, the way your finances go. It's that kind of nuance in there over what we wish we had control over and what we don't.
Right. Who says they're colorblind?
There's people, you know, Stephen Colbert makes a joke about it all the time, but there are people who say, no, I don't see color.
Yeah, I think they don't. I think they don't know. They just don't know. They haven't had an experience. They think that being colorblind means that they don't see a bad thing when they see color. But that's just one tiny little thing. I mean, every case is so particular. You know, sometimes if somebody has a different color hair or somebody, people respond to you on, there's so many different things that, so color is always a part of it. You know, race is always a part of how people are responding to each other.
Do you feel, I mean, you can write a play about absolutely anything that you want, mm-hmm. but do you feel any kind of responsibility that a certain amount of your work has to deal with Muslim American issues because you're one of the few voices?
You know, it's a good question. My mom is definitely has been advising me for some time. She's like, "Stop it with the Muslim thing, Ayaka." And so I'm like, "Mom, I didn't choose it. I mean, it just sort of happened."
Why does she want you to stop?
I think it's, you know, I think her sense is that, you know, from my perspective, I'm writing about experience. I'm writing about people. I'm writing about work. I'm writing about what it's like to live in America. I'm writing about what it's like to not know who you are. I just happen to be writing about characters whose experience is also informed by the fact that they have Muslim origins. I'm not writing about Muslims. That's something that's coming from the outside on me. I'm not saying I'm going to write about Muslims. I'm just writing about people I know. And so it's that kind of external, you know, Du Bois talks about double consciousness. You know, it's like the
W.E.B. Du Bois, who wrote The Soul of Black Folk.
Right. It talks about double consciousness where, you know, minority cultures will often see their own experience through the eyes of a dominant majority. So I'm not writing from a place of double consciousness. That's not my experience. I'm not looking at my experience from the eyes of white folk. I'm looking at my experience through my own eyes. And I don't know why I am, but I am. And so I'm writing from my experience. Now, it turns out that because many of my characters are Muslim, there's a Muslim on stage. That's what it looks like. Let's watch it. But that's not what I'm writing. I'm just writing a guy. One of the reference and one of the facts of his life happens to be that he was brought up Muslim. But it turns out that particular guy in this play hates Islam. So he's a Muslim who actually hates Islam. So there you are. That's the paradox right there. That's where the play starts. It starts with that paradox. So to me, I mean, I don't necessarily know that I feel a responsibility. I feel like there's a really rich opportunity in the sense that it appears that there's this, there's a lot of stuff that I could write that's kind of already been written, but because I'm writing about it from a Muslim point of view, it somehow feels new. So, like, this is great.
So you grew up you were born in Staten Island, but you grew up in Milwaukee, right?
Yeah, I did.
Is there a large Muslim American population in Milwaukee?
There wasn't when I was growing up. Now there is. Yeah, there's, when I was growing up, there hadn't even been one mosque. I was 10 when the first mosque opened up, and now there's six. And there's two on the west side where we live, where there was never even one. You had to drive all the way down to the southern part of Milwaukee to go to the mosque. So,
I mean, this may be me being a public radio typical navel gazer, but I had to wonder if part of your existential questions over identity related to growing up in a place where you were one of a really small handful of people.
I'm not sure I have existential questions around identity.
You didn't? Isn't that where the play comes from?
No, I mean, I think, yeah, but that's Amir's existential dilemmas with identity. Those are not mine. I mean, I have many, many different characters across an array of many where I have, I would say, at least 12 major characters across an array of, at this point, four works. And when I'm completed with the entire cycle of seven, I'll have probably three dozen major characters, all of whom embody completely different polarities and dilemmas and anxieties. And not all of them are riven by any kind of existential quandary over their so-called Muslim identity. I mean, I have a play called The Who and the What, which is actually set here in Atlanta, you know, which is not, it's a Muslim family, a devout Muslim family, where one of the daughters has written a book about the prophet that gets her dad really upset. And she's questioning the faith, but she's a believer. She's on the inside. And there's no anxiety that this family, the way the play is written, it's like being Muslim is as American as apple pie. There's no question about, and that's has a completely different texture and flavor than Disgrace does, which is also very different than American Dervish, my novel, which is, you know, so no, Amir's dilemmas are not my dilemmas. I wouldn't say that I'm unfamiliar with some of the things he's gone through, but I certainly haven't lived through them at all in the same way.
Do you feel like the person who plays Amir needs to be a Muslim American?
No, I don't. And I think that would just be too hard a demand also to make on the production of this play. You know, there are more than 20 productions in the country just this year alone, and it looks like there are probably going to be as many next year. And over 50 around the world this year. And so, for example...
Wow, congratulations. That's amazing.
Thanks. No, it's crazy. Yeah, it's true. In Germany, I mean, their play is being done in more than a dozen theaters and four of the largest theaters in Germany this year. And you know, German theaters well known for not casting according to race or, you know, they have... So I'm not going to... I don't want to get involved because it's complicated. I think... I was hoping and have been pleased to discover that in writing these roles, a lot of actors of South Asian origin and Arab origin are having opportunities.
Asif Manvi played the role on Broadway.
At Lincoln Center.
At Lincoln Center, yeah.
And they're doing brilliantly, and I would hope that directors and producers, you know, would make their best effort to cast these roles ethnically appropriately. But at the end of the day, you got to try to put the best actor in the role. And so I think that, you know... that's a complicated dance.
So then let me go back to your mom's concern before you leave this conversation.
Yeah.
Do you think she's concerned that you will be stereotyped as that guy who talks about Muslims, or is she worried about the negative associations that some Americans have when you say Muslim?
I think both, probably. I mean, I haven't talked to her about it, but I'm guessing that both. And I, you know, my attitude about all of it has been that... I'm just grateful that anybody's paying any attention. So I don't care about whether they're going to stereotype me or not. I just got to keep writing. I will be defined. You know, Emerson once said, eventually others will sniff out the standards that you hold yourself to, and you will be judged against those. And I think that's true. I think that sooner or later, you lead the way in how you are seen. I don't think that. So, you know, there may be a time where everyone's like, "Oh, he's that Muslim guy or whatever," and I don't. I'm just glad that people want to do my work, really.
As playwright, author, and actor, Ayad Akhtar has played Disgraced, won the 2013 Pulitzer Prize for Drama. It opens tonight at 7:30 at the Alliance Theater in Atlanta. It runs through Valentine's Day, February 14th. Ayad, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Thank you. It was nice to be here.
This is On Second Thought. Atlanta was in chaos in 1906. A French newspaper carried the headline. It said, "The lynchings in the United States, the massacre of Negroes in Atlanta." In September of that year, thousands of whites, more than 10,000 by some reports, gathered in downtown Atlanta to attack black residents. The attackers were armed with pitchforks, guns, knives. Evelyn Witherspoon, a white woman, was 10 years old at the time, and she recalled the incident on Atlanta's WRFG radio in an interview from 1980.
I saw a man strung up to the light pole. Men and boys on the street below were shooting at him till they riddled his body with bullets. He was kicking, flailing his legs.
Not surprisingly, this following conversation may contain some serious and possibly graphic subject matter, so use your discretion. The Atlanta race riots lasted 4 days. The official death count was 12 African Americans and 2 whites, but most historians say the actual death toll was probably much higher. Here to talk about it with us is historian Kalinda Lee. She's with the Atlanta History Center, and an exhibition on the riot will be on display soon. Welcome, Kalinda.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Can we talk about that death toll first? Because I have yet to find a single historian who says that it was as small as 12 African Americans and 2 whites. Why do we not have an accurate count?
Well, we don't have an accurate count in large part because there really was a several decades long kind of whitewashing of this history from the kind of official accounts of the history of Atlanta at all. There was a point in time when it wasn't covered in a local curricula. Most of the text, both school textbooks as well as general histories of Atlanta, failed to really detail the race riots.
And to understand why there was almost a concerted effort to do that, we have to that kind of leads us to where Atlanta was in 1906 in September, because at that point the city leaders really had a lot invested in Atlanta being the city too busy to hate. Right, they had bragged that they were the city that was the model of race relations. Is that part of why they tried to kind of cover up the seriousness of this event?
Sure. I mean, in fact, the city too busy to hate wasn't a term that had been coined yet, but Atlanta was really promoting itself as the capital of the New South, and that was a term that was coined by Henry Grady. But what it meant to have positive race relations was very clearly, not only in the South, but nationally, kind of shorthand for having race relations in which white supremacy was dominant. And so what people had anxieties about, particularly throughout the South, was this notion that there would be Negro domination after emancipation. So if you think about 1865, millions, 4 million African Americans in the South are emancipated. They suddenly become citizens, right, with voting rights, political power that when they had none before. They're developing economic power, and they are within a social milieu to some extent with whites. This caused incredible anxiety among Southerners, and the Southern legislators were particularly involved in trying to disenfranchise blacks. They removed African Americans from state legislatures, and eventually the national legislature as well, and really pushed people onto the margins of society in order to control them. And racial violence was one of the ways in which those populations of people were controlled.
And as a reminder, Atlanta at that point had the largest black middle class in America, so I imagine those anxieties were quite high. But let's go back to this, the subject of political power, because that's what most people point to as the real cause of the 1906 riots was the competition between two political candidates. Explain how this all started.
Absolutely. So in 1868, if I can move back just a little
bit. Right after the Civil War.
Right after the Civil War, African Americans were elected to the state legislature, and within a year, they were expelled from the state legislature. And part of the argument for that was just because they're free doesn't mean they're citizens. And it was absolutely unacceptable to have Negro domination in any way. So the notion that African Americans could in any way control the activities of whites was not acceptable. As we move forward, there's an effort for continued disenfranchisement, disengagement. And in 1905 and 1906, Hoke Smith and Clark Howell were the two competing candidates for the gubernatorial race.
Both of them had strong connections to newspapers.
Absolutely. So Smith had a strong connection to the Atlanta Journal and Howell to the Constitution, and really used those as their mouthpieces and really engaged through the newspapers in a process of kind of proving who was most kind of committed to white supremacy. Smith was arguing for absolute and total African-American disenfranchisement, right? To take the vote away from African-Americans through state legislation. And in fact, he ultimately won the contest. And in 1908, that's exactly what the state did, in fact, vote for and pass. Howell, on the other hand, often is portrayed as more liberal. He was actually not more liberal. But what he argued was, let's not pass legislation in order to disenfranchise blacks, because if we do that, that's just going to bring federal attention. It'll be like Reconstruction again. Well, we'll have federal oversight. We don't want any of that. We have already effectively disenfranchised African Americans anyway. So let's just kind of maintain the status quo in that regard, not bring federal attention in, and also not encourage African Americans to find explicit ways in order to fight back against losing their rights.
So the papers, there were four white papers in Atlanta at that time, and they began to publish articles saying that blacks were running around the city raping white women. And it appears that it was so bad that after all of it was over, they were actually reprimanded by a grand jury that said they pretty much caused the riot with these reports. Is that generally accepted, that it was these newspaper reports that sort of led to this mob?
It is generally accepted, but I would challenge it in order to say that those newspaper reports often were reporting political speeches and other kinds of activity. So the papers are pushing forward these kind of editorials, but they're also reporting on activities that are just happening throughout the city. And they did, in fact, report not only on this notion that African Americans were allegedly running through town attacking white women, but also that there was a Negro crime wave in general. And they talked about this within the context of even things like African Americans jostling for space on the streetcar, African Americans refusing to give absolute deference to whites that they encountered on the street. So all of that was kind of bundled into this notion of just black misbehavior that had to be stopped, that had to be quashed.
So that brings us to September in 1906. And like I said, people say that more than 10,000 whites gathered in the Little Five Points area and just began pulling blacks off streetcars, going into barbershops and beating them. We have this comment from 87-year-old June Dobbs Butts of Atlanta, and she remembers her father talking about the riots. Her dad was the Atlanta civic and political leader John Wesley Dobbs. June says her parents had only been married a few months when the riots broke out, and her dad stayed inside their house by the front door.
He stayed there with his gun in hand, as he said, protecting their front door. There were at least 4 days of real terror where fires were around them and they didn't know which way the riots were going. They had no police protection. The United States sent in troops. You know, they sent in troops. When they did, they sent them into the white neighborhoods to protect the rich people.
I want to, Kalinda, play you one more comment from June Dobbs Butts. She says that it ended up that her parents processed their memory of the riots in different ways. Her mother refused to ever talk about it, but her father talked about it a lot, she said, and he said the riots ended up helping to shape his career as a civic leader.
He still talked about it and the cause, the root causes, and how he didn't want to hate people. That's what he spent a lot of time. He didn't revel in how many people did he hear left Atlanta or how many people were killed or what happened to the man that they broke in jail to pull out and lynch.
So if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with historian Kalinda Lee of the Atlanta History Center, and we're talking about the 110th anniversary this year of the Atlanta race riots of 1906. And this, I think, is kind of important when we're looking at the riots and trying to remember them and putting them in context, because they seem to have an incredible impact on leaders in both the black community and the white community. Some people point to these riots as having given some impetus to the civil rights movement that came later. Is there a connection?
I think there is a connection. First of all, you know, in September 22nd, 1906, when the paper says, you know, white men take up arms, essentially, it says the time is now, the time to act is now. Tens of thousands of people, as you said, got on streetcars and went down into the Decatur Street area first, where there were a number of black establishments, and literally just started at random pulling people out of establishments and beating them at random. Also, as streetcars were coming in, because African Americans had not heard the news that this was happening and were coming in from their own neighborhoods
to work. Yeah, that was not the day of social media.
No, right.
Get a tweet.
were coming in from their own neighborhoods. They were being pulled out of the windows of streetcars and beaten to death. In fact, that's probably where the death toll, the main death toll, comes from. And you'll see that it was not only men, but women who were killed. And again, at random. So it was no kind of direct reprisal for some notion of attacks against white. What this does for African Americans is really kind of make it very clear that they need to be kind of chastened, that they need to be careful, that they need to be very thoughtful in their interactions with whites, because really no cavalry came in and rescued them. And to the extent that the cavalry did ultimately come in, it's absolutely, as Ms. Dobbs says, where, you know, they came in order to defend whites against black, not only really not reprisals, but self-defense.
I read that at one point when the militia was finally called in, they actually swooped in and arrested 250 black people. That's absolutely correct.
That's absolutely correct. So what ended up happening was that after the riots, arguments are made on the state house floor that the way to prevent this kind of thing from happening in the future is to fully disenfranchise African Americans. And so for the next half century, this becomes the major focus of black political activity, is trying to get the vote back and trying to have representation.
And it's not, and it's in addition to that, let me read this comment from the mayor when he was asked how to prevent future race riots. Here's his response, quote, "The best way to prevent a race riot depends entirely upon the cause. If your inquiry has anything to do with the present situation in Atlanta, then I would say the only remedy is to remove the cause. As long as the black brutes assault our white women, just so long will they be unceremoniously dealt with." And it appears that after this, even though they did begin a dialogue between white leaders and black leaders, that actually this was the root of a lot of segregation. Blacks ended up moving to the west side of the city, and some people's solution was to just segregate blacks out of the population. Do we still see the effects of the Atlanta race riots 110 years later?
Oh, well, we certainly see the effects in that way. I mean, Atlanta contemporarily is the most segregated major city in the United States, excepting Chicago, so residentially. So there's absolutely that impact. We also saw throughout the course of the 20th century a lot of regulation around African-American behavior rights. So there was this argument, for example, that these black brutes were misbehaving in part because they were drinking, think temperance laws, that they were not being deferential in their interactions with whites. Think about total social segregation.
And W.E.B. Du Bois said he bought a shotgun, and this was also the root of some gun control registration as well, to try and keep guns from blacks.
That's absolutely the case as well, yes. During the course of the riots, of course, white mobs were actually breaking into hardware stores to steal munitions. One single store said that they lost something like $16,000 in armaments. If you can imagine what that meant in 1906.
In 1906. It is a totally fascinating part of history, and it's a conversation that continues. That is Kalinda Lee of the Atlanta History Center, and the Atlanta History Center will have an exhibition on this soon. Kalinda, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Before we go, I want to harken back to the conversation we had yesterday about historic photographs, because we got another great story from one of you.
My name is Ed Hall. I live in Atlanta's Beecher Donnelly neighborhood. The precious photo in my family is a Scurlock portrait of my mother's father's jazz band, the Austin Belasco Jazz Orchestra. And this is by, I believe he was George Scurlock, famous photographer of African Americans in Washington, D.C. in the early 20th century. Because my mother glued it to a piece of cardboard, I have been meaning to donate it to a museum that can deacidify it and save it. But it is, of course, as you can imagine, really hard to part with. But I'll get there.
That's our show for today. Tomorrow we launch our year in Georgia music, and I wonder if any of you actually attend music festivals around the state. There's Stopover in Savannah, Shaky Knees in Atlanta, Athfest, Brag Jam in Macon, the Georgia Mountain Fair. There are so many, too many to name. So what do you think is the best music festival in Georgia? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OSD Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.